Hello, I'm Rupert Sheldrake. I'm here with Mark Vernon.
Hi Hello. There, Rupert. Hi.
For another in our series of dialogues. And Mark, this time we're coming up to the end of October as we speak now. And I wanted to talk about the upcoming Festival of the Dead. We're on the threshold of the Great Festival of the Dead, All Saints Day, November the 1st on Sunday, and All Souls Day, November the 2nd. On Monday. And of course, the eve of this festival, Halloween, All Hallows Eve, is much better known than the festival itself. It's become a kind of popular children's festival, and I don't know what will happen this year with whether we'll see the streets full of little witches and skeletons and so on or not. But anyway, the point is that for most people, the Halloween the eve of the festival has eclipsed the festival itself, which has been sort of hollowed out. But I think it's a very, very important festival. And actually, I think this year it's going to be observed more than for many years past, at least here in Britain. Many churches and cathedrals, Anglican churches and cathedrals, as well, of course, as Catholic ones, are preparing to have outdoor services or special commemorations, particularly of those who died of the virus. So it's taking on a particular significance this year because there have been so many excess deaths, as the statisticians put it. I think that all cultures have their way of commemorating the dead. And in all traditional cultures, say African culture, Chinese culture, Japanese culture, the ancestors are considered part of the family and part of the life of the living, that it's very important to relate to them, to honour them, to respect them, and to remember them. And this is the day in the year when we do that. And All Saints Day is the blessed dead, the people who are certified as saints, and also all those who've done so much to help the rest of humanity. And All Souls Day is really for everybody who's dead, and particularly remembering those who've died recently in the last year, and family members. And I was sort of thinking about this in a new way as a result of seeing the improbable Disney film Coco, which is about the Day of the Dead in Mexico, where it's a huge popular festival. All Souls Day. And of course, it's a much more important festival in Catholic countries than it is in Protestant ones. And on the continent, in Catholic countries, people visit the graves of their ancestors, light candles, clean the graves. So the churchyards are ablaze with candles at this time of year. But this Disney film portrayed the Day of the Dead as a time when the living could relate especially to the dead by usually with their photographs and saying prayers. And then there were these, it's a cartoon film, and then the dead crossing over a bridge to revisit the land of the living on this one day in the year when the doorway opens for them to reconnect. And then there's this whole drama, as you know, sort of set in the land of the dead on that day where someone goes to visit the dead from the land of the living. The dynamics they portray there is that the dead are in a kind of intermediate zone where they still very much relate to their friends and family. And if their friends and family remember them and have their photograph up and say prayers for them, especially on All Souls Day, then this continued life in this liminal realm continues. But when people stop praying for them, then they kind of vanish from that realm and presumably move on further. And I thought it was a very, very interesting portrayal of a kind of popular understanding of purgatory, which presumably in Mexico is very much what motivates these enormous celebrations, which are a huge part of Mexican culture. And I found the whole film brought to life, as it were, the dead, in a way that was very astonishing as part of popular culture. And I know you've seen it too, so I was interested in what your reflections on this are.
Yeah, and I was very grateful for the recommendation when you said have a look at this, because actually there's a hell of a lot going on, as well as it being a very enjoyable film. And significant that it's become, you know, quite a successful film, I think, in popular culture, not just in Mexico. I mean, I find it very fascinating that that in itself, and as you were saying at the beginning there about how Halloween has become the big festival in a way in more popular culture. And I wonder the significance in that itself, because All Halloween is about sort of disturbing boundaries. It's the evening when the children come knocking on the door, you know, when they can do things that they wouldn't be able to do at usual times of the year. They ask for sweets, which in a way are to give them a bit of a sugar rush, a bit of a high. So there's something slightly drug-like in the festival as well. And I wonder whether it's become so popular because we're not quite sure how to connect with the dead. And so we're at that prior stage looking for rituals or means of reconnecting with the dead. You might say Halloween is the festival of the psychopomp, the pattern, the ritual, the spirit, the evening, the night, you know, the soul of the night that can carry us back to better contact with the dead. So that's how I kind of come to understand, you might say, the inner significance of Halloween and becoming so big. It's like unconsciously people want to connect with the dead, and they know that that's done through ritual, through trespassing, it might seem in one moment, or actually is it crossing a threshold as it looks in another, to encounter the land of the dead, as happens so, you know, tremendously in the film. And I really like the film when, you know, this is a bit of a spoiler alert, but the lead character does something that crosses a threshold that the living tell him he shouldn't do. And what's so fascinating is then the details that unfold. So one of the first things that happens is that he ceases to be visible to the living, but starts being visible to the dead as the dead start to be visible to him. And that sense of, you know, what rituals can we do to enter this more expansive reality, it sort of struck me. You know, once we've actually kind of want to connect with the dead, what can we actually do to do so in a way that isn't just spectacular, but actually is meaningful? And, you know, brought to mind for me this practice, which we've talked about a lot before because I'm involved with it, your wife Jill is involved with it, of constellations, which in a way is a way of being in contact meaningfully with the legacy of those who have lived before and how it still impacts our lives now. It's really very remarkable because in some ways it's quite simple. It's almost just an invocation. But then with someone who's kind of skilled in how to navigate contact with previous generations to help unfold it. But, you know, in my own direct experience, I've actually found out things about ancestors of mine through this constellations practice that I didn't know before, but was able to check up because, for example, my grandmother left notebooks, which I subsequently discovered relating things that came up in this constellations practice. I loved it in the film that in a way the dead are quite close, and all that it takes is the right kind of ritual or action with a bit of wisdom as well to know how to engage the legacy of those who have died for a whole new world to open up, and that's good both for the living and for the dead. So that was at least the first kind of thought.
Yes. Well, I think constellations are very interesting because they are a way in which increasing numbers of people are relating to their ancestors, to the patterns in families in previous generations, not just to individuals, but to families, you know, the ancestors in general, the family of the previous generation, the one before. And I suppose that in the past, when people wanted to relate to ancestors, what occurred to many people was seances and spirit mediums, where you'd relate to the dead who'd speak through a spirit medium. Now, of course, that's been, it goes on. There are spiritualist churches, there are lots of mediums who do this. a lot of people find it helpful. It was investigated scientifically by the founders of the Society for Psychical Research, and there are still people investigating this. And I think there's no doubt that some mediums have information they couldn't have had by normal means. But it puts all the emphasis on the medium as the channel of communication. And I think that the family constellations movement is in a way much more inclusive. It makes people much more engaged as active participants in this, rather than going to this special person who has powers as a channel, or sometimes pretends to have powers as a channel. The family constellation thing is more inclusive, and I don't know if it's more effective. I've not seen anyone do comparative effectiveness study, but certainly it's a way that I've found myself very, very helpful in relating to my parents, my grandparents, past generations of my own family, in a way that feels healing for me, but I think it can also be healing for them. The point of family constellations is that if there's been a disturbance in a previous generation, the parents or the grandparents' generation, often because a person's been excluded from the family field or ejected from it in some way or excluded themselves, bringing back that person into the field of the family, enacting it through a family constellation, has a healing effect on the family. Even people who weren't at the constellation, who didn't know about it, estranged members of the family living today, often experience a change. So that implies that it's not just us changing the way we think about the ancestors. It may actually be reaching back and influencing what's happening to the ancestors themselves, even though they're now dead. And of course, that was the basis of the belief in purgatory in the Middle Ages. The idea was that you praying for the dead can actually help the dead in their journey onwards through this post-death realm.
Yeah, I mean, just on that latter point about purgatory, I mean, you know, I'm involved with this Dante project and both a series of YouTube podcasts and writing a book that will be out next year. And one of the things that happens to Dante as he travels up Mount Purgatory is that the souls he meets regularly ask him to remember them to their loved ones when he returns to Earth, so as to ask for their prayers. But what's also interesting is that the way that the souls ask for the prayers of their relatives changes a lot as Dante rises up Mount Purgatory. And the idea is that as they rise up Mount Purgatory, they come into contact with souls that have, as it were, processed their struggles and their failings, their traumas and become more open to the divine. And so the prayers that they ask for as they go up Mount Purgatory more and more, you notice it's as much as about the souls being able to accept the prayers, to be able to accept the grace. They're more settled in themselves. And then that is what has good effect. Whereas in the very early stages of purgatory, when they encounter souls that are sort of wandering around, aren't quite sure what's happening, are lost and confused, very interestingly, haven't even realized they're dead hardly. And some of the souls say that it takes a long time, months, maybe years, for them to even get to Mount Purgatory because they were hanging around in the land of the living, maybe not wanting to leave their lives behind because they were quite good, they were quite pleasurable, or bemused at what had happened because they had a sudden death. Those souls in the more confused state don't quite know how to even ask for the prayers of their relatives. They make mistakes, you know, they ask for the prayers of illustrious relatives that actually don't really have very good effect because they're sort of not quite sure how to make the right prayer. And what I like about that is that it fosters this sense, which I think you were alluding to, about how this is something which we can all be part of, actually. That it's not just like uttering a prayer as if it was a magic spell that then releases someone out of purgatory. It's actually much more conscious, much more deliberate, and for all concerned about becoming more and more open to divine life, which is the direction of travel, well, through this life and also in the afterlife. I think that the practices on All Souls Day and All Saints Day that you can go to in churches, certainly in the bigger festivals like the Day of the Dead in other parts of the world, in their more sophisticated, nuanced forms, that's what they're fostering as well. For us in life to deepen our relationship with the dead, with our own death, with our own bigger story, in order that we can become more and more aligned with the divine flow that's sustaining this life and I think will carry on sustaining us through life into the afterlife. So I found Dante very, very helpful in trying to deepen the sense of what's really going on here when, we pray for the dead and what they might be receiving as well, a sense of being linked and joined.
That's fascinating because, yes, after all, this is a major medieval taxonomy of these different realms of the afterlife. And I suppose that Dante must have based this on a lot of contemporary thought and understanding. He didn't just make this stuff up, presumably.
Yeah, no, he's he drew on a lot of the thinking in the 11th and 12th centuries, particularly, which was a time of great development of ideas of the afterlife in the Christian world. And in fact, they drew a lot on the Islamic world, where ideas of the afterlife were already quite advanced, partly because of the story of the prophet's night journey, where the prophet travels into the heavens and experiences the heavens as multi-layered. It's not just one place that you kind of go to and then sit happily ever after. The journey continues in the afterlife. And so that fostered great interest in that. And I think in a way was the Christian remaking of what had been told in different but parallel ways, say in the ancient Greek world, where the stories of myths and encounters with deities and so on, differently. But nonetheless, you start to see the parallels. So, for example, Plato in the Republic, the last chapter of Plato's Republic is actually an extended account of a near-death experience where someone travels into the afterlife and again encounters various kinds of soul in the afterlife in various stages and then comes back and is able to help people to develop a sense of how to be ready for the dead in this life, help the dead in this life, because there is this continuity. It's not, certainly not this end, and it's not even that much of a radical split either.
Yes, very interesting. I mean, there are where he also has the Inferno, and now the people in the Inferno are the ones who are less fortunate in their role. I mean, how does he portray the role of the condemned dead or the damned dead? Because there's that other category of the dead. And with the Day of the Dead, as in the Mexican film, they're actually carrying on an ongoing life not unlike this world in many ways. And purgatory is a kind of, in a sense, a continuation, a continuous development of this world. But on the medieval view, not everyone goes there.
Yeah, well, I think Dante is very revolutionary in this. They encounter, first of all, when they enter the Inferno, the area of Limbo, which is actually the area of the afterlife most like shown in the film. It's pretty much like this life, there's light and joy and colour, but it just sort of goes on interminably and people aren't quite sure what it's for. It's a bit of a meaningless life. But then they travel, Dante and Virgil travel into the Inferno properly. And I think what's going on there actually is that in order to enter hell, Dante himself must enter hellish states of mind, because it's the state of mind that you have that enables what you see. You must sort of share in the realm that you're entering into in order to enter into it. And so as he descends into hell, he discovers the hellish parts of himself as much as he encounters souls who are trapped in hell. And I think that this reflexivity is Dante's way of beginning to show that hell actually is not a state that, as it were, is just objective, fixed for all time. It is a state of mind that even in this life, people can become trapped in. But when you wake up to how you're trapped in it, that's the beginning of new states of mind emerging, which is why Dante goes right to the bottom of hell, and then that's the turning point, and he finds himself entering purgatory. I think that Dante's encounter with these different facets of the dead in the Divine Comedy is his way of saying, look, this is actually what might happen in the afterlife as well, that people can get trapped in hellish states. But if you can prepare yourself for that possibility now, then that leads to the possibility of moving on from those hellish states too. And by the time you get to the paradise, it's actually pretty explicit that Dante has realized that all people eventually enter the divine embrace. But it can take, but he's serious about how, the transformation that's required as well. And it's not just an automatic ticket to heaven. You know, God, if you like, doesn't want robots that have just been blessed and sing the praises unthinkingly. He wants real people, real souls that have seen all of reality, know all of themselves, so that they can fully consciously embrace the divine life. And in the film, I think you get just a snippet of that with, as you mentioned, these souls sort of disappearing when the living stop remembering them. And for me, that was a moment where maybe this is the film pointing towards something which Dante, you know, explores in other parts of the Divine Comedy as well. But yeah, hell as a state of mind that's real, you know, states of mind are real. It's not to say it's just a state of mind at all. I think that the world, we know that even now, the world that we live in now is very much shaped by our perception of the world, our capacity for seeing more or less. You know, you get this in psychedelic research, where people will often say now that how you encounter what shows up in a psychedelic state very much shapes what you see in the psychedelic state. And so the setting for that is so important. The wisdom is returning, I think, if that makes sense to you.
Mm. Well, it does. And I think psychedelic experiences are taking people into these a wide variety of realms of conscious experience, that some of which can be hellish. I mean, some people have bad trips and have hellish experiences. I've had some myself, and so I think there's probably more people are exploring these realms today than, I mean, it's not the kind of thing you'd ever explore just by doing a standard university degree or anything and learning stuff to pass exams, but people are exploring this through psychedelic experiences. And of course, by paying attention to dreams, because dreams are another entry into a world of where there are bodies, but not bodies as we know them. We ourselves have dream bodies in our dreams, and in our dreams we can meet people who are now dead. And these are things which are not esoteric. Everyone dreams, and so we all have a taste of some other realm of being every night, even if we forget most of it. I haven't read Dante, I'm sorry to say, but one of the most moving portrayals I came across of a kind of hellish realm was in C.S. Lewis's book, The Great Divorce. I don't know if you've read that one.
Yeah.
I found it very, very powerful. And, you know, where he gets on this bus and he finds himself going to this other realm, and it's a bit like Los Angeles. Everyone there sort of say doesn't like anyone else who's there. So it's sort of like a sprawling suburb that's grey and sprawls further and further and further as everyone tries to be as far away as from everyone else as possible. And and it's a kind of Los Angeles turned into a kind of grey, hell-like zone of meaningless, continued life, but in utter drabness and meaninglessness. I don't know how that maps onto Dante. He must have read Dante, since he was a very sophisticated scholar.
Oh, no, he was a complete expert on Dante. You know, the medieval literature was really his academic expertise. And actually, there's quite a lot of work done now showing how the Narnia stories too of C.S. Lewis map onto the heavenly planetary spheres that Dante travels through in the Paradise. So I think that quite a lot of Lewis's imaginative literature actually is sort of retelling the Divine Comedy for our times. And that sense of grey, meaningless expanse echoes the experiences of Dante in the hellish states. That, for example, people are so preoccupied with their past or so anxious about the future that they can't inhabit the present. And that means they don't really see those who are immediately around them. The colour of the present drains away. Again, it's an experience which people have now, sort of let alone in the afterlife. These things, we can practice it now, I think. That's part of the meaning of being in touch with the dead, because it's our future, and in that way, they have things to show and tell us now. I've become more and more convinced, actually, that on the biggest scale, this life is the chance where we can ready ourselves for more life in this life, and which involves these kind of self-reflections, these understanding yourself, what limits, what constrains, what holds you back, trauma, of course, too. But also that is readying for the next life as well, and that somehow what we are capable of when we die will shape what we experience when we die. I think ultimately is a comedy, but it can be a very long, slow process before we return to the divine. So I think, yes, Lewis and Dante are onto the same kinds of things. I mean, Lewis's genius is that he does it much more subtly in a way. A lot of people, I think, reading C.S. Lewis wouldn't realise that he's training us for the afterlife and deepening our sense of connection to different realms, different states of mind and different beings as well. But I think he is.
Yes, it's so interesting, isn't it, that as well as all this going on, there's a lot of research around the process of dying. And it was just ignored for long time. It was like a medical failure, and people were in intensive care, and then they died, and that was a kind of failure of the medical system. But with the hospice movement and research on experiences around death, for example, Peter Fenwick here in Britain has done a lot of this research, interviewing people who work in hospices, and many have experiences when they're around dying people of, you know, they see something of the process of dying. They see, sometimes share in those altered states of consciousness that the dying people are going through. And attention to the process of death and what follows it, particularly after death contacts. A lot of people are bereaved in the few days after or weeks after the bereavement, experience the presence of the dead person as a voice, as a presence, as a touch or smell even. Relatively recently, these after-death contacts were simply not known about, and many people engaged in bereavement counselling didn't know about them either, and people who had them didn't want to say anything about it to anyone because they were afraid they'd be thought to be mad or that they were seeing ghosts or something like that. So there's been a tremendous taboo about all these areas, which luckily is breaking down at the moment. And this is, it takes on a practical significance in hospices. And of course, there's always been this sense of preparing for that moment of death. In the Hail Mary prayer, which I myself say every day, the bottom line is, Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us now and at the hour of our deaths. So this idea that Mary can act as the mother, the womb is the tomb. The idea of the Great Mother is both gives birth and also takes people on through death. Death's like a kind of birth into the other realm. And Stan Groff, as you may know, in his work on LSD experiences in the 60s and 70s, found that many people who had LSD trips underwent a kind of near-death experience of feeling constricted and trapped, and then going through a kind of tunnel and emerging into the light, which was blissful and joyful. And he sees that that near-death experience, which is what happens in near-death experiences to many people, as a kind of reenactment of the process of birth itself. When we are constricted in our mother's wombs, it begins to contract. It's no longer a comfortable place to be. In fact, it's a hellish place to be. We're constantly being squeezed, compressed, contracted. Then there's a way out through this tunnel, the vaginal canal. And then we come out into the light and a whole new life begins. So he sees that as a kind of archetype, and praying to the Holy Mother to pray for us now and at the hour of our death, asking for the protection of this maternal principle which can give birth into this life and into the next.
Yeah, it's incredibly rich. I mean, it complementing that too is the opening line, Hail Mary, full of grace. And I think that Mary is the type for us in another way, as divine mothers can be in other traditions. And because the point about the divine mother is they take the divine into themselves. They don't just know the divine at a distance, and they don't even just know the divine through imagery and symbolism. The divine is literally born in themselves. And so she becomes a type for us all because of the incarnation that, you know, as Meister Eckhart puts it, the important incarnation is not the one that actually happened sometime around 0 BC/AD. The important incarnation is the one that's happening now inside all of us. And so Mary and the Divine Mother is a type for us as well. Can we in womb, as it were, the divine in our lives, in order that then through this birthing process, particularly around the time of death, we can join the divine in the afterlife as well. And so these prayers, which are said sometimes a bit mechanically, just a bit of reflection on the living and the dead actually profoundly enriches them. They're tremendous things to say.
Yes, I agree. Well, I think our time's up, Mark. Sometimes people say I'm always hurrying us up, but we do try to stick to a fairly limited time. But I, for one, will be paying attention to All Souls Day this year and lighting candles and going to a service and praying for those I know who've died this year and for my ancestors. And this is something open to anyone. And actually, it's easier now than ever before, because so many churches and cathedrals are paying more attention to it this year than they have before. So it's actually a very topical issue and something we can actually do something about.
And I also think that when death comes near, which either does through crises like COVID or at the time of year like now, this is a moment for new life, as it were, to something to be conceived inside us. You know, life and death, ascent and descent are deeply interwoven. And, you know, maybe even our dialogues can help that with people, if you know they something is seeded in their minds, something new perhaps to try out. You know, this is just the beginning of new life. It's a great time for both ends of the life cycle, life and death, the two come together. And I hope people, you know, can perhaps even feel that a bit as they think and contemplate these things.
And I think it's appropriate that it's young children who are actually leading the way into a revival of this consciousness, because it's through children that Halloween, at least in Britain, has been revived as a festival and opening the way for this deeper understanding. And that the fact that children are part of it is very much emphasized. It's not just about death, it's about new life.
Yeah, they're closer to life in some ways. And so closer to the boundaries of life, and out of the mouths of babes and sucklings and all that as well. So thanks very much.
Well, thank you, Mark.